Hey everyone, my name is Mike Connors. I'm an assistant news editor for the Massachusetts Daily Collegian, the only student-run print and online newspaper here on the UMass campus serving the community since 1890. And this is the official podcast for the news section of the Collegian called the Collegian News Hour. We're recording today's episode on Monday, February 25th, but this, like every installment of our podcast, will be released at 8 o'clock every Tuesday morning on SoundCloud and Apple Podcasts. So here in the studio with me to recap the stories that they've covered in the past week are the rest of the news team, if you want to introduce yourselves.
I'm Catherine Esten.
I'm Irina Kostake.
I'm Abby Charpentier.
I'm Alvin Baenza.
I'm Will Malice.
And I hope everyone's having a good week. Yeah. So let's get started with our first story. We had a pretty crazy SGA election last week. Alvin and Catherine, you were there when they announced the so-called results, and I'm putting results in air quotes because there really wasn't many of them. If you want to talk just a little bit about that.
Sure. So Alvin and I were there. We got there just after midnight on Thursday night, so that's Friday morning. And they were expected to come out with the results around 1, so we did get a chance to do some pre-results interviews. And the environment there was everyone was excited, looking forward to the news. And just after 1 o'clock, representatives from each of the campaigns, including the ballot campaigns, came down, and results were announced for everything except for president and vice president. And Alvin, would you like to talk about how people reacted to the lack of results?
I mean, there's two reactions. So we had one from Timmy. Timmy was pumped up and excited to do this again. I mean, he even stated that he would literally do this all over again if he had the chance. And then there was the Ally McCandles in Moshka Padmaraju team. They were a little bit more shocked, saddish, I think. It looked like they were very, very, like, shocked. Like, they did not find it too amusing that they would have to they might have to do the campaign all over again in face off against Timmy. They did lose by 12 points, but the thing is that it's only 12 points, so it's a tight race. I mean, it looks like the percentage of people who voted during this election were pretty split between, you know, the McCandles Padmaraju team and the Sullivan and Latimer Ireland team.
12 points or 12 votes?
12 votes. Okay. Votes, points, you know.
Right, 1,523 for Sullivan and Latimer Ireland, and then 1,511, doing my math there, for the McCandless team.
Right, and it's like that kind of polarization. I don't think we as a campus have seen a lot of, like, I've never seen, going back to SGA elections, like, something where the votes were, like, so polarized like that in a long time. And so that just shows that, like, this was a good campaign, this was a good race. I remember, correct me if I'm wrong, last election, I remember that either Margolis or McCandles was in the last election as well.
Stephanie Margolis was, right.
Margolis was in the last election. I don't believe McCandles was in the election.
She was not a candidate last year.
Right, right. And so, like, I feel like people at the same time might need some new blood, and that's what could have sparked this kind of polarizing effect. But I think we're just going to have to wait and see if there will even be a special election. It takes them a month.
Yeah, so to comment on that, the night of, everyone was under the impression there would be a special election. So if you read our article, a lot of the reactions we had were the candidates thinking, you know, we're going to do this again. We're ready to get back out there and start campaigning. And then there's been a lot of questions in recent days over the validity of that by SGA bylaws. So that's something that even as of tonight, we don't have an answer to, of whether there will be one. From looking at the bylaws myself, it looks like we wouldn't be entirely sure for about a month, because the Elections Commission might not have the power to call a special election for the first 30 days. So we are still awaiting results on that.
So the Elections Commission and both tickets are waiting basically on Student Legal Services for their interpretation of the SGA Constitution, correct?
That would be correct.
So the Constitution says that the winner of an SGA election either has a majority of the votes or plurality. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So if, you know, the interpretation that comes out of SLSO is that, you know, plurality, meaning Timmy Sullivan's ticket won technically by 12 votes, probably like less than a percentage point, I guess, that would mean that he would be the winner, correct?
Mm.
Does anybody else see the sort of issue here in the sense that the Senate would have to ratify that, right?
Yeah, so the election results, even the ones we've been reporting on, they will have to be ratified by the SGA Senate. In the past, there have been close races. So we have the example of in 2015, the race for president was decided by 4 votes. Mm-hmm. So this would actually be a wider margin than that year was.
What happened in that year?
In that year, the team that won by 4 votes won. There wasn't a special election of any kind. The results did get ratified by the undergraduate Senate. So it looks like the reason they postponed this year, it was kind of cryptic, but in the original elections report that was sent out, they said there were complaints that were sent to the commission that they still needed to review, and they'd do it in a meeting this week. I didn't get a direct answer of whether those complaints related directly to the presidential campaigns. However, given that a majority of the complaints tend to be about that race, I think it's a safe assumption to make.
In terms of my opinion on this kind of like the shortcomings of the race, I said before that it shows that there also needs kind of this need for new blood. But kind of going in, let's say, for example, if there's a special election, right? And we either get Sullivan or we get McCandles as the president. Going in, I don't feel as if that's going to fix any of the larger problems with the SGA. So they're still struggling with things such as unity as an organization. They're still struggling with things such as generally getting campus energy to go out and vote during the election. They're still struggling with things like such as getting the campus and the SGA involved in communication with one another. So it'll be interesting to see how Sullivan will be able to cope with those new problems or how McCandles will be able to cope with those new problems.
I'm also interested to see if, SLSO comes back and says that Timmy won since he had a plurality of the votes. I'm curious to see the reaction but from the McCandless ticket, or if it goes the other way, the Sullivan ticket. I assume that there is some sort of recourse that they could take if they disagreed with rulings that the Election Commission took, whether that be through the judiciary of the Senate, or of the SGA, rather. So I don't know. That's just something to think about. I'm not sure about the specifics about that. I'm not like a SGA constitution expert here, but I definitely don't think that we're seeing the last of this. All right.
Oh, Jake Bernal won, student trustee.
Yeah, true. Uncontested candidate. And surprisingly, on our Facebook post about this article, all the comments are actually about his victory and not about the fact that we don't have a president. I thought that was nice.
Yeah, so Jake Bernal won, student trustee, and all three of the ballot initiatives were passed. So at least we have something to come from that as of right now. But no president yet. So let's move on to the second article. This was written by one of the assistant photo editors, Will Catcher, also a reporter for us. So the University of Massachusetts system employees represented 97 of the 100 highest paid workers on the state payroll in 2018, according to the Boston Globe. So the Globe cited data from the state's Office of the Comptroller. They published a list of the 100 highest state employee salaries, and a lot of them were from UMass. So some examples, Matt McCall, he's the basketball coach, I believe, sitting at 9th place, and he's earning a hefty $537,000 salary. So that's a lot of money. Also, $503,000 is going to Mark Whipple, who is no longer the football coach, but was the football coach. I don't know. What's everyone's thought on this?
It's interesting when you look at some of, like, even more specific. Like, one thing that surprised me was the highest paid UMass Amherst employee was Derek Lovely. He's a distinguished professor of the College of Natural Science, and his salary was $630,000, and he was right above Chancellor Subbaswamy, who earned, it says, roughly $580,000. That kind of surprised me that, you would assume that, the chancellor is, at least a chancellor of UMass Amherst would be making the most out of the school, but it's actually a professor.
Yeah, I think it also just really makes you think about, like, where the allocation of our funding is going to. Like, there's so many people that are paid, like, more money than they would honestly, like, ever really need in their life. But at the same time, like, there's students on our campus who can't afford to eat or who can't afford, like, a full meal plan, can't afford to eat, who can't afford housing or just, like, tuition in general, have to take out tons of student loans, and that's a burden on them, so...
I mean, the article says that Michael Collins, who is the chancellor of UMass Medical in Worcester, makes $1.06 million. That's higher.
Insane.
That's a lot. That's higher than Marty Meehan, the president of the UMass system, former congressman Marty Meehan. He holds for fourth place, and he earns roughly $660,000. So that's like almost a little bit over half. So that's a lot of money.
I know.
And I don't think any of these people really need that much money, personally.
Yeah, and to even compare to that, Governor Baker makes about $151,000 annually, and that's increasing to $185,000, and people made a really big deal about that. And I'm not sure he even breaks into the top 100 in the state. I didn't check that, so he could be up there in the late 90s, but, you know, that's definitely shocking to see such a wide disparity between UMass officials and state officials.
Pretty wild stuff, for sure. And I'm sure that this is not, you know, the first year that most people on the, highest earning state employee list have been from UMass. It's a pretty big institution, but I don't think that that necessarily means that they should be paid as much as they're being paid.
Devil's advocate, but their pay is in relation to essentially their worth at the university. So the reason why Kumbhasumbaswamy is getting paid over $500,000. Yeah, over $500,000 is because he's pretty, like, he's the chancellor of the flagship public university in this state. Like, he's the chancellor of one of the top 25 research institutes in the Northeast. I mean, like, I feel like what people are trying to say is that, oh, they shouldn't be paid that much because they shouldn't just get paid that much. Whereas my thing is that, okay, there's a reason why they're getting paid this much. I would have a problem if, like, it'd be $500,000 going towards just somebody who doesn't really do much at this university. That'd be my problem. But, like, these are people who, you know, their worth at this university is tied to how much they make because they have that level of importance.
So, you know, Subaswamy is earning roughly $580,000.
Right.
And you're saying, you know, a pretty decent point that, you know, he's pretty integral to...
Yeah, that's how much he's worth to the university.
But it doesn't make sense to me that, you know, the successor to Mark Whipple, Walt Bell, he's getting paid $625,000 per year starting next year. Now, I'm not sure if Subaswamy's salary is going to go up, you know, accordingly as well, mm-hmm, but why is the football coach being paid more than the chancellor?
Because football brings in a lot of traction to this university.
Aren't we the last team in D1?
Yeah.
Don't we have, like, the worst football team?
But
we
still bring in a lot of traction to this university.
I would argue that it's just wealthy donors that bring in a lot of the traction.
Yeah, that's the traction. That, like, even though, like, we're... Okay, I don't want to, like, shit on any of our sports teams, but, like, even though we're, like, last in D1, we're still bringing a lot of traction in football at this university. Like, those wealthy donors are essentially there. They're the result of that.
I just don't see the purpose of building, like, a new practice facility if we have students on this campus that are literally starving.
True. Yeah. And my thing when I said that is that, like, I was trying to get to the point of essentially saying, like, there's a reason why they're getting paid this much. I'm not trying to take away from the fact that there are students who are struggling with housing, food, books and stuff like that. I think there should definitely be more allocation of funds into housing and money and food. It's just that I was just trying to get the point, like, there's a reason why they're getting paid this much.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, let's move on. I don't want to spend too much time on this next story because I feel like we've talked about Hampshire College a lot. But there was an interesting development in the Hampshire College search for a strategic partner last week. So the Daily Hampshire Gazette, through a public records request, and I think also NEPR, obtained emails between high-level officials from Hampshire College and UMass over a potential partnership. So some highlights from these emails, there are about like 70 pages of emails that were released. You can read them on the Daily Hampshire Gazette website, I guess, if you're interested. But basically, Hampshire College, about 5 days before they announced their decision to search for a partner, the president of Hampshire College, Miriam Nelson, wrote that she hoped that UMass would sign a non-binding letter of intent in, quote, the not-too-distant future, and that she had been speaking with Subbaswamy. That letter of intent was never signed. The university is citing that the parameters of that were unclear, specifics were unclear, so they're not moving forward with that. But it just goes to show that Hampshire College was actively vying to take UMass in as like a partner in their search. So this is like what people have been speculating for a while, but it had never been actually uncovered until these official documents came out. The other three schools in the five college consortium, so Amherst, Smith, and Mount Holyoke, had apparently all been supportive of Hampshire and UMass partnering together. So are we going to see another Mount Ida situation with UMass? Is this going to happen?
UMass Hampshire. It's going to be a thing. Like UMass Hampshire. Like it's going to be a thing.
The official line is that they're not really talking anymore, but they're open in the future to a partnership, depending on, different sets of circumstances. But I don't see how this doesn't happen. Like, I really don't see how this doesn't happen.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it happens this year. I think it might be a couple more years. And a big part of that is, Mount Ida at least was near the city. There are other schools that people could have seen Mount Ida partnering with. But Hampshire was started by UMass and the other three colleges in the system, and I think that it doesn't really make sense for them to go outside of this area.
I would push back a bit on that, because I know the president of Hampshire College said that they are looking to announce by June a partner. So whether that be UMass or they come up with a way around that, I'm not sure, but I think it might happen sooner than we all expect.
I mean, the thing is, and this is what I said, this is what I touched on last time. This is what I'm going to touch on the same thing again. I don't think Marty Meehan is ignorant of this kind of humongous opportunity that he has to combine UMass with Hampshire College. I think this is on his radar. I doubt that this is not a discussion that they're not having. My thing is that on the counter side is that when Marty Meehan, if UMass decide to take up Hampshire College, they're going to have to take up a lot of Hampshire College's problems, which is what? Financial issues, which is essentially integrating a different culture. So Hampshire College is very liberal. And when I say that, I understand that our college is very liberal too, but they have a liberal kind of education system where we still have still a very traditional education system. So when I say that Hampshire College is very liberal, I'm not talking so much about their politics, I'm talking about the way that they teach. It's a very new, different kind of style that UMass is going to have to deal with. How are they going to deal with a teaching style where they don't have grades? UMass has grades. They're going to have to deal with the debt crisis that Hampshire College is in. Like, how do they even do that? And so that's going to be a situation.
Yeah, and Hampshire College has said previously that they want to maintain their independence, and whatever sort of partnership that they end up having with whatever institution they choose to join with, but definitely something that we're going to have to keep our eyes on. Let's move on to the last article, something light. Mary Pope Osborne, author of the Magic Treehouse books.
Yes, so if any of you have read those books, you had a chance to meet her last Wednesday at the Eric Carle Museum of Picture Book Art. So that's actually on the Hampshire College grounds, just to tie it into our last story.
Fun.
So that was a fun day. I got there just before the event. They had a special play going on based on one of her books.
Which book?
It was on the Shakespeare one.
Oh, okay.
I can't remember the full title of it, but I think it was A Midsummer Night's Dream. Some play on that title, like Monday at Midsummer Night's Dream or something. And it was a really fun event because, you forget when you live on a college campus, how many kids are out there, I guess. We don't really see people under the age of 10 a lot. And those books, which were coming out from before when I was born, it was really great to see all these kids so excited about it and waiting in line talking about, this is what their favorite book was.
I cannot believe that they still have these books. I thought these
books
died out.
Yeah, books are still coming out.
Like new ones?
Yeah, there's new ones still coming out.
Like, have you read the new ones?
I have not read the new ones.
Oh, I forgot that we're all adults.
I think I faded out somewhere around 2010, but maybe someday I'll get back into reading them.
It won't take you that long to read, as if I can remember correctly. They're only like 30 pages long.
Hey, hey, Mike, shut up.
Diss. I'm just saying that, you know.
Oh, it was stage fright on a summer night.
Got it.
That was it.
Did you meet her?
I did get to meet her. So after getting enough interviews to do the article, I jumped in line. I bought a copy of the first book because got to go back with the original.
Mm-hmm.
And after waiting in line, she was very friendly. She took a picture with me. And her first, you know, her question was, she was saying, it's so nice to see old readers come back and know that there's still these generations who are inspired by the book.
I mean, those books for me were like super inspirational. They're just fun.
Yeah, did you have a favorite book?
Did I have a favorite book? I like the Merlin ones.
Wrong.
What?
it's wrong opinion. I'm sorry.
You didn't like the Merlin ones? Those were the cool ones.
No, I like the Jackie Robinson one. I liked the Ninja one, of course. I like the one that they, what was it? Like somebody gets in an airplane, right? Magic Tree has
some. Sure.
there's dozens of those books.
No, but like they meet like Amelia Earhart or something like that.
Yeah, they meet a lot of people.
I'm pretty sure like somebody gets in an airplane and does something. That was a good one. Did anybody read the Percy Jackson books? You did, yes. Catherine.
I mean, I don't know if we've ever had a discussion about it, but yes, I did read those books.
Okay. And you read all the Harry Potters, too.
I was a very literate child.
Yes.
I'd agree with that statement.
Yes.
Well, you know, Mary Pope Osborne, J.K. Rowling, whoever wrote the Percy Jackson books.
Rick Riordan.
Thanks for just showing me up. But regardless, that's a pretty cool event and seemed like a lot of fun.
Yeah, sure. So stay informed with what's going on in your communities. You never know who might be visiting.
Yeah.
I just have to say one thing. I really like how Mary Pope Osborne was, like, really humble about it. Like, I feel like she was going to be a J.K. Rowling situation where she just keeps on trying to rewrite her books. But I'm really glad, like, she was really humble.
I bet she busts those out really quickly.
She brought off. Can you really stop shitting on this, like, 80-year-old woman?
I'm not. I love her. But, you know, just saying.
All right, Mike, you create an international children's franchise.
No, like I couldn't. So that looks like all the time that we have for now. It was great having everyone tune in, and be sure to listen next week. So once again, I'm Mike Connors.
I'm Catherine Esten.
Irina Kostake.
Abby Charpentier.
Alvin Baenza.
Will Mouse.
And you've been listening to the Collegian News Hour. The theme music for this podcast was created by Joaquim Carood and promoted by Audio Library. Make sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and drop us a rating if you enjoyed today's episode. Or if you disagree with me and my Mary Pope Osborne thoughts.
Slander.
My slander. You could tell me in the reviews. Why not? It helps us out. So thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll be back next week.